everybody. Welcome to Shop Talk Show. This is a very special rapid fire episode. Yes! Where we answer as many questions as we possibly can in as short time as possible. Let's kick this thing off. Ba, 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 ba. I should say, we're sponsored by, I forgot to mention the sponsors at the top of the show, but we always kind of do that just to say big, big time thanks to our sponsors. This week we have, again, Mijingo, Mijingo.com. Check them out. They do intermediate level screencasts for learning about the web. We'll talk about them a little later in the show. And we have Environments for Humans, and we're going to tell you about a really cool conference they have coming up in Hawaii. We'll tell you about that a little later, but let's... What do you think, Dave? Should we? What is Shop Talk Show all about?
Well, Shop Talk is a podcast about front-end web design and development. It's good to be back here. We're doing another rapid fire, as you guys probably have noticed. We've been a little bit out, but that's okay because we're here answering your questions still. It's like Back to the Future.
This is special. These are just me and Dave episodes, so no guest and just all questions. No drama, no nothing. All right, let's just do it. I like when we get right into it in these ones. Yeah, so this one's from Zach Brady.
Okay, here we go. Oh, that was a finisher. I need the starter. There we go. Okay, from Zach Brady. Here we go.
Hey, Shop Talk Show guys. I love your show. My name is Zach. I'm a front-end developer from Westchester, New York. Sometimes back-end, not really design, but mostly front-end. This is kind of more of a frustration than a question, and kind of seeing if other people share my frustration or if I'm missing something. And my frustration has to do with how padding attributes, simple thing, but how they affect an element based on the box model, and basically a frustration I have with the box model, that the padding adds width to the element rather than, let's say, shrink the content space. This becomes a problem to me when creating fluid columns. If I don't want the content to touch the edges of the column, let's say I have a border around on the column or something, in most cases I could solve this by going column, asterisk, margin left, margin right for all the elements, and then that would kind of be a fix. However, let's say I have an image within my column that I want to grow and shrink with the column. So I set it at 100% width, but because of the margin, it breaks on the right a little. So if I could put padding on a column without breaking my grid, this image problem that I just said wouldn't be there. Is there something that I'm missing that would make my life easier? Or, again, do you share this frustration? It just seems like this really basic thing that we kind of take for granted or don't think about, the fact that padding adds width. I'm speaking with emotion right now because currently it's really frustrating to me.
Oh, I thought that was
again,
funny.
Again, guys, I love your show so much. Take care.
The emotion part of that was so funny to me. He's like, what's that?
I just get it. I'm just like, when you've been like coding for like 16 hours straight and you're just like about to just throw your computer out the window. I know what it's like. I know. I heard it in his voice.
I know. The good news, and I like replied to Zach right away when we got this email, which unfortunately I can't do to everyone through email, but I did for Zach just because I knew how frustrated he was, and the reason is there's such good news like waiting for you, Zach, and that it's essentially this is the border box or the box sizing issue, right? So if you have an element that has 100% width on it, or is just width auto or whatever, by doing nothing to it, an element, or if you set like width equals 100% or whatever, and then you add padding to that, it'll be 100% plus like, and you say 20 pixels, it'll really be 100% plus 40 pixels wide because it happens on either side, unless you put on that element box sizing border box. Then that 40 pixels of extra width will come out of the inside instead of the outside. Am I understanding him correctly? I'm pretty sure that by setting box sizing, it's like going to solve all your problems, Zach.
Yeah, I think it definitely will. And just a little history, like that. So Internet Explorer used to do that, like in IE, whatchamacallit, way back in the day. And then
it did, but it did it, like, people say that more than it's true, I feel like. It did that in Quarks mode, which was kind of rare, and it only happened, like, if you had a crappy doc type or something. Like, it wasn't just the default IE model.
That's true. Yeah, it would just show up, and so you just, for some reason, thought that's how it was rendering. And then Firefox or Netscape or whatever you want to call it, Mozilla, would do it the way where it would add width, you know. And then people kind of like came around and were like, hey, it'd be a little better if we could add padding to the inside. So that's box sizing.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you don't set a width, it does kind of come out of the inside. Like if a div is just is left in its natural state, as being as wide as its parent element, you can add padding to it. It will come through. But sometimes you need to set width equals 100%. For example, on a text area, text areas need to be width equals 100%, or they won't stretch to be as wide as that. So it's just really nice to be able to set widths. And a lot of times we do this in responsive design because we're setting a width of like 25% or something. If you're making a simple grid, you have to set it width. And then as soon as you put padding on it, it screws up. So just the popular thing these days is set that box sizing border box using the star selector. Just put it on every dang thing on the page, including your pseudo elements. And it is a happy day.
Yeah. Well, and I've seen somebody once told me, and this is a thing, that if you put an image in a box sizing border box, it can sometimes break that container kind of cruddy, just like he's describing. But I haven't been able to replicate it if you're using padding. If you're using margin, it may still break it.
So, I haven't seen that use case, but make a code pen, send it in. We'll follow up on that if there is a weird use case. But I've been using this on everything.
So, good. Yeah, I mean, it's your jam, right?
That's totally. And it's IE8 and up, and I don't even care if it was IE9 and up. I'd still use it.
Yeah. The headaches it saves, it's pretty awesome. So... Well, there you go, Zach. Hopefully that'll save you frustration. And
Zendy Wanzo. Zendy. What's the people's first names to start with? Z. It's an awesome trend. I love it. I am a web developer, and for the last year or so, I've been focusing more on the front end. I'm at the stage where I want to learn more by getting my hands on some coding. I want to start contributing on GitHub, but I don't know where to start. Most of the repos that I start are already at an advanced stage. I feel like that I'm not at that level yet. Please give me some suggestion of where to start, or maybe how you guys started previously. So I thought this was kind of an interesting question. It is I want to be a GitHub hero. I want to be a part of somebody's repo, but a lot of times you just look at a repo and you're like, ugh, where do I even start on this thing? What do you think?
Well, so I'll start where I started. I started by open sourcing something, and I think that was like lettering.js back in the day. And you know, that was like totally I'm just going to release this and see what happens. And, you know, people helped out and I learned a lot. Like, Paul Irish gave me some code help and code review. And so did Alex Sexton, both of those guys from the YayQuery podcast. I mean, gosh, invaluable help there, you know? So the best thing you could do is probably release some of your own stuff into the wild and then ask your friends or peers or, you know, anyone in your kind of social circle to take a look at that. And that would be step one. Step two is docs are terrible on every project in on GitHub. So, I mean, you know, maybe it's as simple as just saying like, hey, I could help you out with your README, you know, and like, you know, your you're like pulling some stuff down to edit that, or maybe their examples are terrible, or maybe they like, maybe they have bad design or something, like, you know, their little demo could just be tidied up 10% more. Not, don't, you know, don't be a hero there, but like maybe they're something could be a little better to explain it a little better. I think that would help immensely. So what do you think, Chris? How'd I handle
it? I like that idea. I like a lot of those sentiments of helping on things. I mean, there's a few obvious things we can say, like, have you used somebody's project that's on GitHub and ended up having to make an alteration to it in which to work for your project? Maybe you could just, you know, have that in a fork, you know, and be like, hey, listen, this is how I had to change your project to get to work for me, and put that as your thing on GitHub and let them know that you've done that. You can just like analyze your own skills and abilities. You can be like, listen, well, I may not be able to like jump in and totally grok some big complicated project like Node.js or something that's on GitHub. But what are my skills? You know, like, well, I'm pretty good at like writing semantic markup. Even if you're just like kind of an HTML guy, I could look at a project that I'm interested in and really look through the markup that they're using and then, you know, fork it, keep your local copy and see if you can improve the semantics of what's going on in that project and commit that. Like, you know, like, yeah, or whatever. Or maybe like do a cool, if you're a designer, do a cool logo for a project. You know, that the design help I feel like is needed more on GitHub than developer help a lot of times. So just kind of lots of little ways to jump in.
Also, I want to direct you, the HTML5 boilerplate team, who you've probably heard of, you know, Divya, Paul Irish,
Nicholas Gallagher,
Adi Osmani. So they have this thing called Lazy Web Requests up on GitHub, h5bp/lazyweb-requests. And basically these are their ideas. They want these things done, but they don't have time to do them because they're obviously engaged in stuff like boilerplate and HTML5, please, CSS3, please, and their day jobs. So, I'm looking at like 100 things they want done right now, 98 things. And you could do this. You could kind of like cruise through and follow up on some conversations and see if there's something you could maybe contribute to. You know, there's, you know, sometimes they just want like a chart, or sometimes they just want, you know, somebody to write a how-to, you know, just very simple stuff. You know, I think that would be an awesome place to get involved. And like, you know, not for nothing, as Matt Marquis would say, you are like playing with some really amazing developers there. So that would be my direction for you, Zendi.
Very good. Very good.
Next comes from Clark Pan. And Clark, or Z Clark, as we like to call him, as is the trend, he's asking, I want to know if there's any performance considerations between using multiple identical media queries compared to using one giant long media query. The reason I ask is I want to try to modularize my SAS file. God, that's a hard word to say. Modularize my SAS files include how it responds to each media query breakpoint. That way it's easier for me, for the maintainer, to see what each element does within each breakpoint. However, if I do this, I potentially end up with lots of media queries, a whole set for each module of styles. I want to know if browsers optimize for this or us, or if it runs the media query again each and every time.
Classic SAS question. Yeah. I feel like this may have come up before, hasn't it? It's kind of that, like, you can nest media queries in SAS or less. And it's pretty cool because, like, it keeps your thinking together better than, like, putting just one big media query at the bottom of the page where you kind of readjust styles. You're like, okay, this div has a width of 80%, but at mobile style, it has a width of 100%. Like, keeping those two things right next to each other, I find very nice. I don't know if you agree or if you do that or whatever.
No, I totally, yeah, like, I'll say this from a recent project, and maybe I am repeating myself, but from a recent project, we built it all in SAS, which using what you're saying, Chris, like we nested everything, like kept modules together, and then it spit out these media queries. But everything, we were playing a little too fast and loose, I think. And so, like, we ended up with, like, 70 different breakpoints or something dumb like that. Poor planning committee, right? So, in the outputted CSS. And so, at one point, we had to hand over just CSS because they weren't using a preprocessor mm-hmm. there. And when that happened, when they weren't using a preprocessor, we just decided, oh, let's make it simpler for us. And as we're building this out still, to kind of bundle all the media queries together in the manner that Clark's describing, kind of just right. make it one big media query at the bottom of each CSS file.
Yep.
That was cool until we got asked to like break our CSS up into even smaller files. And then we had to like go through and basically uncouple everything and put it back into components. So my advice is always do the modular route. And here's why. You're asking like, is it basically the browser treats media queries like either like another degree of specificity, like you'll see that in your web inspector stack. It's like, oh, here's the media query. It goes on top or whatever.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't literally exactly affect specificity, but I know what you mean.
It doesn't literally. Yeah, but it's just kind of saying like, hey, this is being applied now. But then
the fact that it doesn't affect specificity is a whole issue unto itself, which I'll get to in a minute. So finish here.
That would be, yeah. We could talk about this for a while, but it treats it like another style sheet.
Yeah.
So if you like do like document.getStyles or whatever it is, and it'll actually show up as like a style sheet, the media query will. And I hope I'm not lying here. I think I'm telling the truth. Last time I did, it did. And,
well, it kind of tells you what media query is. Like if you open the Chrome Web Inspector, it kind of says like, oh, this app media, like this style is part of a particular media query.
Yeah, so if it treats it like a style sheet, browsers have been doing multiple style sheets since the beginning of time almost. So therefore, it's going to be good at that. I don't think you can have too many. I mean, maybe like some weird, I don't know, Android's going to bomb out if you have more than 200 styles or something. But I don't even think that's true. I'm lying to you now.
Yes. Oh, that's okay. So a lot of this is just coming up a lot because people are really like sensitive to what their lesson sets and stylus. Or I don't even know if stylus can do it. I kind of don't think about stylus very often. Nothing against them, but I don't know it very well. They look at their compiled CSS and there's just little media queries just peppered throughout it. Like, you know what I mean? And okay, mm-hmm. Number one issue about that is, yes, that's a little inefficient, possibly. But as Dave taught me once in the past, gzipping eats repetitive stuff for breakfast, right? So if there's the same string over and over and over and over in a file, the gzip algorithm will sense that and do magical things to make that file smaller. And the gzip sizes, because you're gzipping your site for sure, right, everybody? It's pretty easy. And if you don't know, you may already be. It's not that complicated of a thing to do. It's mostly a directive in your htaccess file or a setup in your nginx file or whatever. It's probably not a big deal, so don't worry about it. That's what I'm going to tell you. Like, if you're worried about this peppered media query thing, I'm telling you, just don't worry about it. Number two, SAS is kind of aware of this issue, that like the team of SAS, and they're like, hey, maybe we can fix that at some point. I think they're thinking about it. Three, the problem is they're not willing to change the specificity of the outputted file. Like, what you write and what you think the specificity is going to be when you're writing SAS needs to be what the specificity is when you're done. And if they were to just group them all and move them to the end of the file, they would be changing the specificity because source order matters. Because just being in a media query doesn't affect the specificity level of the selector, the source order of where it appears in the CSS, it does matter. Do you follow that? Like, is that,
yeah,
like if you were to just move it lower, then another selector that it wouldn't have been overriding, now it does override because it's lower in the file. So like, it's just weird. Like they didn't do this on purpose. They didn't like the, they're aware that it's a little repetitive outputting it the way that they do, but they did that on purpose because to not screw with specificity.
Yeah. So, I think Clark, don't worry about it.
Yeah. There you go.
I mean, it's sort of like, it would be cool if we all had these like super never repeating a single media query ever style sheets. But man, I mean, like, here's what will happen. You could do all your code and you know, it's going to be perfect balance. And then somebody's going to be like, hey, why'd you do it that way? Or some dude's going to write a robot in 2 years that'll cull all your CSS on Minify and spit out the same breakpoints and
style sheets. I'm trying to find the style sheet on CSS tricks. Oh, this is so classic. Style on CSS. Let me look. Shoot. How did I get into this stupid view? There's a lot of CSS on CSS tricks. It's pretty, you know, there's plenty of stuff going on there. Pretty big style sheet. I pepper my media queries all over in that thing. Big style sheet. After it's gzipped, it's 8.6K. Okay? So, don't worry about it.
Yeah. Don't worry about it.
I want to do a little sponsor here. Ryan Ireland has this lovely company called Mijingo, MIJINGO.com. Pretty weird, kind of a cool name. I think of them as intermediate level web training, kind of, right? There's some places where you can go to get, you know, very basic training. That's probably the easiest thing to find online. There's a number of good services and stuff. Even CSSTricks.com, there's some beginner-level stuff on there. But these screencasts that you find on Mijingo.com are more like you for the Shop Talk Show listener. Guys already kind of know what they're doing a little bit, care about web development enough to listen to a podcast about it, right? So, like, there's a lot of good stuff for Expression Engine, if that's your CMS of choice, or if you want it to be. It's kind of a pretty designer-friendly content management system. They have tons of stuff on that. But I'll tell you about a brand new one that is very relevant to some stuff we've been talking about recently on the Shop Talk Show. This is a brand new screencast. It's only $9, available on Mijingo.com, and it's by Ryan himself, and it's called Static Websites with Jekyll. Now, Jekyll is a static site generator, right? So like what goes up and gets deployed to your website, there's no database. It's just like HTML files. They go up there. But of course, there's some magical backend stuff. You run all that stuff locally. It's just that what you deploy ends up being static. That's what why they call it a static website generator. And Ryan tells you all about how that works, getting it set up, how to get the stuff on your site, what are the advantages to it, that type of thing. They're great. They're really fast. The websites end up being really fast, you know, really easy on your server, really secure because there's not much to hack, you know. It's really kind of a neat way to build a website these days. So if you want to learn all about that, brand new screencast on Mijingo.com, only $9.
Yep. There you go. It's really good. I will also say this personal note. I know Ryan, and we were working at a coffee shop one night, and I was working on my blog redesign, which is, you know, perpetual. I'm in limbo, right? But I was having, like, you know, like issues with like CodeKit versus Jekyll and stuff like that. But he helped talk me through it, man. And then it was awesome. So, I'm going to say firsthand, he's helping me, or he helped me like kind of make the jump to Jekyll and, get my blog kind of going. So now it's a matter of finishing it, right?
The ultimate skill in the web design.
Redesigning your own blog.
Being a finisher.
Well, all right.
Yeah.
Thanks, Mijingo. Well, let's go to the next question. It's an audio question from Richie Arnold. Here we go.
Hi, guys. You've been talking a lot lately about printing websites. I'm currently building a website for a client which allows users to design wardrobe doors. Basically, the user selects a width and a height and the number of doors that they want. They can then drag and drop different materials onto different sections of each door. So a door might have a section with a wood effect, a section with a mirror, or it might just be a colour. These sections are just divs with CSS backgrounds or gradients or colours. Now, the client wants the user to be able to print their design. So I thought easy, just add a print style sheet, hide the header and footer, and just print the image of the doors. The problem is, because it's made up of empty divs, the doors don't print, because by default, HTML backgrounds don't print. As far as I can see, there's no way to override this setting. So, any ideas what I can do? Thanks for your help.
All right.
I'm Googling madly because I've come... Don't rely. Oh, look, there's a CSS Tricks article that I totally don't remember writing. But it's here somewhere.
Oh, to be Chris Coyer.
Okay, so let's see. Is this Firefox? It's just a browser. First of all, do you know anything about this, Dave? Have you read into it? Or
yeah, so the situation, he described it well, is backgrounds don't print. Like if you had a background of a kitty cat on your website and I hit, you know, Command or Control P and printed out a version of your website, the cat would not show up because I don't want to waste ink on a cat, you know. Mm-hmm. That's kind of just the generally understood. And then is there a way to override it? I don't know. I don't think there is in my immediate mind frame.
First of all, the article I wrote is freaking clever. This is smart. Anyway, so I had a calendar. I want to describe to you this article because it's so awesome. I was working for a client back when I did client work, and there was a calendar, and so there's this grid of months all over it, right? And each of the dates had a different color on it depending on what time of the day they were doing. It was like a show, like, you know, they were putting on a show, and different days had different times they were doing the show, and they were color signified. But we wanted a way for people to print this out, throw it on their fridge or whatever, right? But the colors didn't print, so it was a disaster, you know, like, very few things are a disaster in web design, but like, how can I get these colors to print their background colors? Well, I just didn't rely on color. And I'm not sure if this will work for you, but what I did is I used different border styles to signify the different times. I used dashed, I used dotted, I used 2 pixels instead of 1 pixel, single pixel, whatever, and then matched those to the times. I don't even remember doing this, but it was a pretty smart solution, I think. But you're talking about wardrobe doors, so I don't think putting a dashed background on something is a solution for you. Maybe if there's only a couple choices, maybe it will.
Yeah.
But maybe, let's see. You know what? I ran into this the other day, though, and there was there's some WebKit-specific property that tells the printer to print the background color. And you know where I used it? I made this invoice thing, and we actually use it on Chop Talk, too. Where it's like an editable invoice thing. And there's a, you know, like you just type in some stuff and you can print out an invoice. It's just this really simple, like content editable kind of thing. And at the top, I put invoice and I put the bar in black and the words in white. So if you print that out on a printer, it won't print the black background because that's what we're talking about here. Backgrounds don't print. But it will print the white then in like really light gray, so it knows that don't print white text either. It's just doing some smart stuff for you in the background. There is a WebKit-specific property that you can put on that thing that will tell the printer to do it, and it will honor it. I just can't freaking find it. Google is failing me here, but I'll try to remember to put it in the show notes. There is something, and it's just for WebKit. So I'm not sure if that will help you either because, you know, you might as well do it, I guess. But... it's just for WebKit, so you can't really count on it. And I have a suspicion it's not all WebKit. It's probably, you know, some version of WebKit and up. If they have old Safari, maybe it won't work. If they're in Firefox, there's literally a checkbox, or there used to be. So you could inform your users that if you're using WebKit, maybe it'll work. Hopefully it will work. If you're using Firefox, there's a checkbox you can do in the print settings. And again, that probably is cross-platform dependent, all kinds of new stuff there. And then there's another thing here in Chrome. I just found a Chrome extension that will enforce it. So you could tell your users, hey, if you're using Chrome, install this extension, and it will force printing to have background colors in it. They use like this little nice little Wikipedia page as an example. Oh, here it is. Oh, cool. I have it. Okay. Are you ready, people? Imagine CSS in your mind. I know this isn't great for the radio. You have to go colon root, which is just kind of selecting the HTML element. You could probably just use HTML too. And then open bracket, dash WebKit, dash print, dash color, dash adjust, exact. That's the WebKit way to force something to print its background color. And I bet it's just print. It'll print a background texture too. It's not just color only. I assume it will print background. That's the WebKit way to do it. Good luck. This is a hard problem. Maybe there's some fancy way that you can take your background color and make it an image instead, because you know images in the HTML do work. So maybe you can somehow position it just right so that it will print that way. It's a hard problem. Good luck, Richie.
Yeah, I think other things, maybe aria role equals image would help. I don't know, but then.
But you can't put that in your CSS. Maybe you can. Yeah, well, you'd put it on the element that CSS effects
is generating, yeah. You could look into maybe like spitting out a canvas or something like a, like they're manipulating this thing.
What is that thing where you can run WebKit like on your server? There's some little thing.
There's like a
and then you can
WebKit kind of thing.
Yeah, and then you can take a screenshot of that on your server. Yeah, that's clever too. We're actually looking into that on CodePen, because we're thinking of for static demos and for like the RSS feed and stuff, it would be cool to show you an image of it, which will actually save us some server stuff and make the page load a little faster and stuff too. So we're looking into ways of taking screenshots of web pages kind of server sidely. It's turning out to be super complicated, of course, but what are you going to do?
Huh? Yeah. Nah, I think, dude, tough problem. But I think you're going to have to just maybe take a step back and add a little bit more, Richie. So hopefully we answered your question, yeah? Next question. Bill Hernandez wrote in and asked, have you heard of this? And it was post to – I love it. And it was post to a marcomedia.com.au post about – IE 6, 7, and 8, and 9, and I think the gist of the post, I'm going to remind myself a bit here, but it was to get, like, you basically, it's a command line tool to get, like, what is it, a screenshot of the page in Internet Explorer 6, 7, 8, and 9.
I think this is different. I mean, it's so first of all, Microsoft maintains free little copies of Windows that you can run that will fire up IE 6, 7, 8, and 9, right? They just give you these for free. They're virtual machines, though, right? It's not like a real, I don't know what it is. I don't know how they reconcile giving away these for free, but they do somehow. Then you can download the software VirtualBox. VirtualBox is a free version of thing that's like, have you heard of VMware Fusion or what's the other one? Parallels. These are paid virtual machine thingies that you can like then buy a copy of Windows, install it through Parallels or through VMware Fusion and run Windows side by side with OS X. VirtualBox is like that, only it's free and it's pretty good. So it's got to hurt the business. What's that? So
this is just a virtual machine that you can download with just one version of the browser in there.
Exactly. And he's showing you in this post how to just grab from GitHub those Microsoft-maintained virtual machines that have IE 6, 7, 8, and 9 on them. Very cool, I think. You know, like these days I do most of my testing in browser stack. Costs a few bucks, but it just fires up a VM for you right in the browser and you can test. It's really nice, I think. So I kind of prefer that. But if you're looking for free, and if you're looking to do it like really like not through the web, you want to like really look on a virtual machine, and you're like need to do some serious IE testing, but do it on a Mac. This is a good way to go and a free way to go.
Yeah, this looks pretty awesome. I wish I had known about this yesterday. I might even have to check this out, but because I have like I have a PC unit and I do use that. I switch between Mac and PC kind of regularly through testing, and but it would be nice to have like this convenience, you're out somewhere with only one laptop, but then again, this looks pretty good, man, because you can get all the IEs on your Mac. Pretty cool.
Yep, yep, yep. And if you already have Parallels or VMware Fusion, these virtual machines will work for them too. I'm pretty darn sure.
Cool. Well, somebody, Bill, try it out. Let us know how it went. So there you go. Next.
Steve Sullivan asks, what do you think about Google's recently released style guides? Now, this question might be a little old. I'm not sure. Sometimes we dig into the archives a little bit on sent in questions. We want to get to everybody's question that you send it in. Still a relevant thing. So Google, the company, releases just some like best practice kind of stuff for HTML and CSS. Like what's the best way to write it? Not, you know, not like decision making, but like literally like formatting and stuff like that. Like, do you put all your selectors on one line and then put one space between the opening bracket and then return and then two spaces before you write your property and then a colon and then one space after before the property, you know, like really like seemingly nitpicky stuff like that. But those type of things really end up kind of making a big difference, especially on teams. Just because it's basically annoying to look at somebody else's code that has a different code styling as you, and you can like end up, you know, spinning your wheels, you know, rewriting their CSS just so that they end up rewriting yours and be like, nope, stop it. Let's agree on a format and write in that. And so Google just kind of says, this is what presumably this is what they use as a company. They say, if you're going to write CSS for Google, it should look like this. And then they just kind of, I don't know that for sure, but that's why I imagine where this came from, and they just decided to make it public. Do you know anything about it?
I mean, I'm sure it's just something they have, and they just put it out there. There's been a lot of these floating around. GitHub's was super notable. Nicholas Gallagher posted one that is also super notable. And man,
he works for Twitter now, so that's presumably kind of what they're doing.
So, yeah, let's just call it Twitter style guide. So, I mean, gosh, I think style guides are great. I mean, just the more the merrier. Like, if your team can communicate, and I used to be very like, nah, man, it don't matter, just whatever, right? But, like, the more I get into, like, trying personally to maintain a style guide, the more I get pissed when it's not maintained. So it's kind of like once you've like crossed over, you like see the value. Obviously, that's how most propositions work. But I think they're cool. I mean, some of these might be super too strict, you know, like, for example, if Google's might be way more strict than your company needs, you know. But if you're trying to be acquired by Google, it might be a great thing.
I put a wrap-up of these together the other day, and I looked through them all because there's some good stuff in this Google one. There's some, you know, I really like Nicholas Gallagher's work, and then there's the GitHub. You know, like I kind of picked out what I thought was kind of the most interesting bits from all of them, and just did a little roundup post. I can link to that. But yeah, I'm a fan. I'm a fan of having, you know, taking a little pride in your work. It's kind of one of those craftsman type of things, you know, like if you, you know, just take a little care in how you do things. It's kind of visual proof that you're a CSS craftsperson, not just some slop hound.
You know, interesting story. I watched that Apple video about the new iPhone 5000, and they spend a good time talking about the back of the phone and how they polished it and how they made these. They spent all these. They built a machine to like match up the back like plastic piece with the black like brushed aluminum piece and stuff like that. And I mean, you want to get into like craftsmanship? That's it. So like. Same thing with your CSS. You're just not, you know, you're trying to make your code pretty and readable and understandable. If you have more than two developers, maybe fork Nicholas's project and kind of come up with the rules on your own. That would be my advice. Yeah.
Heck yeah.
Next, we got a sponsor. Hold on.
Ah. added the ukulele, folks, because me and Dave are going to Hawaii. How do you feel about that? I'm pretty excited about it. Never been to Hawaii. That's what they say for hello and goodbye, and maybe love, too. I think they might just wrap it all in there. Either that or they have like 60 words for love because they love so many things there. The reason that we're going there is for environmentsforhumans.com, the conference producing powerhouses that is Christopher Schmidt and Ari Stiles. High five, guys, are doing a face-to-face conference, and not just one, but two of them, back-to-back in Honolulu, Hawaii, this early December. Let me look up the dates exactly so you guys know exactly what dates we're talking about. In Control is, I believe, December 2nd through 4th. Do I have that right? What's the schedule here?
I believe that's true. Believe
yep, that's true. Then the 5th is CSS DevConf, so CSSDevConf.com. So they run back-to-back. Me and Dave are going to be there. We're going to talk about the web. There's some big names there. Jessica Hish, who's been on the show, is going to be there. Brad Frost is going to be on the who randomly, when you're watching this in time, there may already be a Shop Talk Show episode with him out, or there may not. I'm not sure yet. Dave McFarland's going to be there. He's been on the show. Dave Rupert's going to be there. He's on the show once in a while. Estelle Weil's going to be there. All these Shop Talk people are going to be there. It's going to be like a Shop Talk party. It's going to be amazing. Go to incontrolconference.com and buy your ticket to Hawaii. Christopher wanted to tell us to tell you. Well, there's three things I got to tell you that's important about this Honolulu, Hawaii trip, which you're all going to go on. One of them is right now is a really good time to buy Hawaii tickets. He has somehow scientifically calculated that right now is the cheapest time to buy tickets. There's maybe some variation in when you're when this is airing or whatever, but in the real world right now, it's a good time to buy your airfare. Don't wait for the last minute. As a frequent buyer of plane tickets, don't wait till the last minute. You will spend too much money. Instead, use some cool web app. Maybe we should link up some cool web app that's like PriceAlerts.com. But you gotta get your airfare going for this Honolulu trip. So buy that. That's number one. Number two is the speakers for CSS DevConf have been announced. They were kind of they did this super cool thing where you'd like vote on who your favorite speakers were. The data is in and the speakers are announced for CSS DevConf. That's a big thing. And three is if you want to go to this thing, and I hope you're serious about it, convince yourself that this is a good idea. But not going to be just fun, which it is, but also super educational because this is a big, awesome conference. In Control is one of my favorite web conferences ever. I've been to several of them when they're in Orlando. It's also you can save $100. Use the show Shop Talk to save $100 off this off going to Hawaii with us. Come on! Thanks to Environments for Humans for sponsoring the show. Cha-ching! Let's do some more questions.
All right, here we go. Next question is from Aaron Callhammer. I love any name with
hammer. Hi, Chris. This is Aaron from Mayville, Wisconsin. I was reading this article about the new image source set tag and how frustrating it is and how I have to upload multiple images and high-resolution images for the Retina display. And it got me thinking, why can't the server handle this? So I dug a little deeper. I went to imgtocss.com, and with this photograph of an iPhone I grabbed off of apple.com, I converted it to HTML. It made it one huge table with all these 1 pixel by 1 pixel TDs with background colors. Right away, I download the file to compare it to the original PNG, and the original PNG was 209 KB, and this file is 369. So it's considerably a lot larger, but we could convert it to CSS, and that would reduce the file size dramatically. Then it got me thinking, why can't it be when I FTP or commit a file to the server converts it to CSS or maybe some new type of file format that we have to invent, and then we use some form of REST technology to serve the mobile user a version of this, but skipping or missing or cutting out every other pixel. So it'd give them half the file size, which would download quicker for that mobile user. And I'm pretty sure it would display nicely on their small smartphone. Of course, we'd probably want to test this first. Convert an image to CSS would be the first test. Then do a display none for every other pixel and see how it looks. I'm thinking then if that would work, all I would have to do is upload a high resolution Retina ready image to the server, and the server would take care of the rest. That's it.
Okay, so quite a bit going on there, but
yep.
Could responsive images kind of be done on the server, or what's your take there, Chris?
I think it's really cool that Aaron is thinking about this problem at all, because it's hard and complicated, and the hardest part of this problem is, you know, it's one thing to be even aware of it. It's two to like just dig in and be like, okay, I got an idea, you know, and just try it out. So if you didn't catch that part, he's like, there's a way that you can take an image, and you could do this with like PHP or, you know, any kind of server side code, and like look at what color is this pixel? What color is this pixel? What color is this pixel? And make a grid, and not just a grid, literally a table in CSS where every TD is a 1 pixel by 1 pixel thing, and you set that with CSS, and then set the background color of that 1 pixel by 1 pixel to the color that you discovered. So you're not putting an image in the DOM. You're putting literally a represent, like a tiny, humongous table of the color. So you're like, you know, that's clever.
A table that's like 600 rows by 300
yeah.
rows, or 600 pixels by
right. Number one, that's just weird. It's going to make this like enormous DOM for one image, let alone many images. And there's kind of, I've actually recently ran into some problems with just straight up DOM weight on mobile. You know, like you gotta keep that light, you know, so having this like crazy big table. And I just think that the like image technology, when you shrink an image, it's doing more than just essentially display nunning every other pixel. It's just more like sciencey than that, you know? And that, like, so, yeah. You know, his idea was just kind of like remove every other pixel and that'll make a smaller version of the image. It would be interesting to see how close to the original image it got, but I don't see that making a perfectly half-sized image. Not to like poo on the idea. It's some interesting stuff, but I think like doing it through a table is just not probably first, you know, usable thing at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. I mean, and as much as I say this a lot, but as much as I'd like robots to solve all my responsive image problems, it's sort of like it's tough. I don't know. I think a lot about like, wouldn't it be cool if there was like, you know, have you seen these like responsive images services like Sentia.io or Sentia has one, Tiny Source, I think it's what it's called. There's another one that just came out. I forget. I think it's RWD IMGS possibly, but
I've seen that.
I wonder if the future is similar to how we have, you know, Redis databases and, you know, these like kind of services that mm-hmm. we have, like maybe we have these open source servers that only serve images, and we put all of our images in there. But even if we have those and these servers are doing their job and they're 100% uptime, you're adding in this like complexity, you know, like, I mean, HTML should be as simple as like an image tag fetches an image file, you know,
right,
but
right, right,
then
right,
we're
right.
adding this complexity where the image tag is actually referencing the image server, which is then, you know, spitting back its best calculation of what this device needs. And it is probably right, but it could be wrong, you know.
Totally. How is bandwidth like factoring into that? And how is art direction factoring into that? And is this really a, is there some way we can not use a third party server, but bring it onto our own server? And it's pretty much the hardest problem going on the web at the moment.
It just seems like if you add in this server element, you're adding this degree of complexity, which is offloaded to the server. That's great, but you're, you know, the spirit of the game, I think, would be one tag that serves images to different devices, different images to different devices or contexts. So,
Oh, and it's assuming that that image format can do it, and I don't know. Like, I really want a good responsive images solution on CSS tricks. One of the way, and I don't, what I don't have is multiple versions of all those images through the history of CSS tricks. I just don't have that. So I'd probably be going for either serve what you already have or a smaller version of it, which is what something like source.centia.io can do, or what a self-hosted version of adaptive-images.com can do, that Matt Wilcox like self-hosted one, which is pretty clever. But how does that also play with CDNs? How does that play with caching? That stuff gets weird too, because I don't want like a mobile device to be the first person to hit that particular page after I flush the cache. Adaptive Images figures out it needs to make a mobile version of it. It makes that URL. The mobile version, that's the one that gets sent to the CDN to get cached. Then the desktop user comes and gets the mobile version when it shouldn't. And like all these stuff interacts in really, in really significant ways. And it's just so hard. And I'm not sure I want to rely on a totally third-party source for serving my images. I already have a CDN, which deals with some of the speed things. But like then you're like, okay, what if I just decide to ignore it and let the world catch up to me? Well, the world is the trend is going the opposite way. All of a sudden, we have Retina now, and now we're not just talking about big images. We're talking about images that are four times bigger, not just a little bit bigger, but really, really a lot bigger. So now it's like we can't just wait around and hope this problem gets better. It's actually getting worse.
What you gonna do? What you gonna do?
I hope Adobe can save us. Some big third party needs to get involved in this.
Adobe One Kenobi, you're my only hope.
I know that,
is a t-shirt.
They've been just doing good work otherwhere, and people need to see our first stage. Everybody feels frustrated about this right now. My solution is half-ass it. Just basically serve what I've already been serving. Serve a little bit of higher quality once in a while, but just use the CDN and just cross my fingers. I'm basically doing wrong by people that have really bad bandwidth, but you know, I do my best, guys.
Yeah.
Phil Thompson.
We're all trying. That's the... Yeah. All right.
Yeah, you're right. He asks us, are landing pages a big no-no in current day web design? I'm in talks at the moment with a potential client who's saying that they may want one, and I don't know whether to talk them out of it or just do it. So landing pages, Phil, what is that? This is a, it's hard to answer. What do you think of when he says that word?
Yeah, so like back in the day, you'd go to a website and there'd be a little page and it'd say, "Welcome to my website."
There'd probably be some like, ukulele music.
Probably a ukulele going in the background. Yeah. Maybe a Java app that took a picture of a beach and made it like watery underneath, you know, and
a little and Java then a big button that said, that "Click to enter website." Those are my favorite.
Basically, yeah. So those are out of fashion. I will go ahead and say, I think Phil. I mean, it depends on your user goals. I think if you can make the case for the user here, like I feel, you know, I often say, like I feel like if I go to a website, I want to at least be able to get some of the most important content on that front page. You know, kind of like hours, directions, time. You know, like. And if that doesn't exist, I'll probably be upset or, you know. But there's other people I know. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but Noah Stokes, Mother Futon on Twitter. He's a very smart, web savvy, intelligent, handsome man. But he would say, just do it. I mean, they're the client. They have their business goals. You're just the implementer of their vision, you know. So, you
they're
know,
saying,
it's kind
do
of.
Do it, do it. Yeah, Dave's right about this user thing. Like, what if this splash page is like a way to capture email addresses. Maybe you come to the site and be like, oh, this is superplane.com. Are you interested in superplane tickets? Put your email here and sign up, and we'll take you to the page, or skip it or something, right? And then so some people will skip it, and some people will enter their email address and they'll start getting superplane emails. Maybe that's like friggin' ridiculously effective at getting email addresses, which are a proven good business good thing for Superplane, right? So now there's the splash page. Users might actually like it because they might want Superplane emails because there's super good deals in Superplane emails. It may be a win-win to have this landing, so-called, quote, landing page on this site. It may benefit the client. It may benefit, you know, you may be a cool opportunity for some fun design stuff. It may make the users happy. It could be great, and it could be called a landing page because it's not really like the main whatever you want to call the main. Like, web pages are just too complex to say. Like, do right by the user, do right by the client, and kind of go for it, I guess. I can't picture exactly what you mean without Phil showing us something. Like, I mean, it seems to me that he wrote this question in because probably the landing pages that he's looking at is seeming to be. I bet he has the gut feeling that it's not a good landing page.
Yeah.
When I think of the word landing page, I think like one of those ones that like we have to build at, where we would have to build at SurveyMonkey so that we could point a Google AdSense ad at it that we would like target to nurses or something. You know, that's what I think of as a landing page. So like we could buy the keyword nurse survey and point that ad to go to a page that's more, that isn't just the SurveyMonkey homepage. It's like for nurses somehow. That's what I think of as a landing nurse. Page.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, those are good. I think those are great for conversion.
Yeah, I don't think there's a right answer here. I mean, I think it's always like, do right by the user. That's sort of where you need to, yeah. Don't frustrate them too much.
Indeed.
Well, cool. I think we got it.
A couple more to get through here. What do you got for us?
Yeah, the next question comes from Peter Dillon, who's asking, is there a way to solve the problem of context or hover menus on touchscreen devices? When on Netflix, if I want to see the hover description, I press, hold, wait for the open a new tab, etc. Click to get off screen when the hover section remains open. It's triggering two things, apparently. So, mm-hmm. Is there a way to solve context or hover menus on touchscreen devices? I'm going to say no. I don't know. Trent Walton, my coworker, has a great article called Non-Hover. You can find it there. But he kind of talks –
it's a little scary about revealing context menus. Does he really talk about Netflix?
Yeah, he talks about Netflix specifically and Basecamp, which is maybe a little out of date since they have a new Basecamp. But he talks about that specifically. You know, it's weird. You don't have right click or right tap, you know. So you don't really have context menus on touch devices. So you kind of have to give up on that, you know. But then there is things like if it has a hover state attached to it, like a hover event or a colon hover or whatever in your CSS, a tap will actually initiate a hover. So, but you'd have to do some JavaScript, you know, to like disable the click or make sure like it doesn't go to a link or something like that. But,
right. That's what I'm imagining in my mind is this, like, test if the device supports tap. Now at the moment, if it does, it means it's all tap, right? Like there's no possibility of using a mouse if the browser has tap events. Now, yep. I hope that doesn't change because it might someday. It might, you know, like what if all of a sudden Apple puts out a new computer that like you can use a mouse or you can touch the screen? Well, then we're in a weird mess, right? So at the moment, you can kind of test for if the browser supports touch events. If it does, then just kind of do some different behavior. Now, I'm thinking of specifically imagine CodePen. Hopefully some of you use CodePen. In the upper right of CodePen, there is a GitHub login button. When you're logged in, that changes to a little picture of you, a little avatar of you. And a lot of the main navigation, kind of, or the things you need to do as a user are buried within a hover menu in the upper right of CodePen. You go up there and you hover over your icon and you get a menu that drops down where you can go edit your settings and your profile and make a new pen and do a bunch of actions. Now, CodePen sucks on mobile anything. We just haven't gotten there yet. It's not really a mobile-ready website. I want to get there. I want to think about it, but it's not like super duper duper high priority for me at the moment, just because like I don't want to code on my phone. Like I might want to browse around and look at some stuff, but like it's not something I want to do. I'd like to get it working on the iPad a little better and stuff like that. But that is a problem, right? We're burying some functions in some hover only menu, which is kind of a no-no on mobile. I've got to fix that at some point. I'll probably end up doing some kind of thing that tests for touch. Now, there's a little arrow on it. So even on a touch device, I think that communicates pretty well that there's a menu underneath it. What I need to do is make sure that do some JavaScript magic that when I tap that thing and it knows that it's in a tap world, all it does is like add a class name called like open or something on that menu. So you can tap it once. The page doesn't go anywhere. It like returns false or whatever on the link, but it also opens that menu. So you can tap it once, reveal the menu, and then tap the menu option you want. Maybe that's what I'll end up doing on mobile. I think that's probably not too difficult of a thing to do. Right, like you just don't have the menu show on colon hover. You show it show on a class name of open or whatever.
Yeah,
maybe.
Oh man, no, I think that's how I usually do it. Is base it off of a class or something, you know. But it gets
and hopefully clicking that menu doesn't do anything super important. Like you don't want to disable, like what if clicking the menu item also goes to a page that is otherwise impossible to get to? Like make sure you're not making some task impossible too. Anyway.
I think the moral of the story is you can't rely on hover all the time. So if you want the super responsive working on everything device, like you got to not rely on it, but you know, like Chris said, I mean, for CodePen, like touch and hover devices aren't really your target market, you know, because for CodePen, most people are there using a mouse and a keyboard and they're coding, you know, so.
I'm not trying to get out of this, guys. I know I'm sure some people are pissed that there's no mobile support or whatever, and I do want to have it. It's just one of those things.
Chris,
yeah,
my butt is so hurt.
Yeah, I don't get that much trolling for this one.
So hurt.
A little bit, but not too bad.
I would say I do like to just challenge myself to write like JavaScript on my phone and just see if I can do it without like a code completer or anything like that. So it's kind of fun. It's tough, and it turns out to be total garbage most of the time. But there you go, challenge. Awesome. Next. Question.
Classic one. I put this one last to begin with. He says, "Hi, my name is Fardim Munir. I just finished class 6, which must be wherever he goes to school. Class 6 is kind of a, you know, something big. And so I have 2 months holidays in front of me. I know CSS, HTML, jQuery, and a little bit of PHP. I was wondering if you could tell me what new thing I should learn." Does that question sound familiar, Shop Talk To listeners? We get this one a lot, and I don't mind answering it every time. People want to know. They know a little bit. They want to know what to learn next. It's probably one of the most common questions we get on Shop Talk Show, and we've used to, I don't know if we have a soundbite. We probably don't. It probably wouldn't make a very good soundbite.
We'll work on one.
But some people did take this to heart.
Answer
yeah,
to
what
this
is
this question?
Yes.
It's just
build
websites.
Classic, right? There's even a website called justbuildwebsites.com that some people made at the front-end design conference that I missed. But thanks, guys, for building that. It's one of the most common answers on Chop Talk Show. Fardim, we're not telling, you know, like, hey, buddy, I don't know what to tell you to learn next. Really, like I think you're doing good. I'm sure, like the rest of us, you know HTML, CSS, jQuery, and a little bit of PHP, but like there's no reason you can't keep learning those things. That's a very robust and good skill set. There's people that know less than that focus on it for their entire career. So you have plenty to learn just by deeper diving into those technologies. But of course, what you should really do is just build stuff. Build stuff on the web. And whatever challenges you come across, conquer them, and that will be your real learning experience. So instead of academic learning, do some real building of stuff, and that will inform what you need to know more. What do you think, Dave?
Yep. I mean, this is the answer. It's just build something, you know? Like if you got an idea, try to build that out, you know? For me, I want to build out a like HTML5 game. So I can learn more about games and how games are programmed and stuff like that. So that's kind of like my secret plan once I get more time. But like that's not so secret anymore. But that's sort of what I think we're getting at is just like build a website or build something and then you'll know what you need to learn. You said you know jQuery. Maybe it's time to dig more into like – JavaScript. Maybe you need to go read Rebecca Murphy's blog post on a baseline for front-end developers and like really know this stuff. Maybe you said you know PHP. Do you know a PHP framework like to build an app like CakePHP or CodeIgniter? Those would be good to learn because that's how you're going to be employable if you like can like build a super scalable PHP app, you know, you say, you know, HTML and you know, CSS, like, maybe you just make a dumb website about Alan Rickman, like, like my company did and, you know, you get on some CSS galleries or something, you know, that's, you know, there's stuff you can do for sure. So spend time doing that. That's what I'd advise.
Sounds like a plan. It's time for us to leave you folks. Da-da. One more time. You know what you guys should all you guys should go to iTunes and Google or do a search for Shop Talk Show and find the thing where you can give us 5 stars. That would be awesome. If you think we're more like a 4-star show in your mind, just forget I said anything. Just don't do anything.
Yeah, you're really bumming me. You're really bringing down the mood here, bud. And I'm really surprised you made it this far if you think it's 4 right now. I'm just kidding. Yeah, also follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for all the updates on when we release episodes and stuff like that. You'll get a little heads up there. Anything else, Chris?
ShopTalkShow.com.